Well, good afternoon. Thank you all for being here. I'm Catherine Kuo from NIAMS, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Gordana Vunjak-Novakovic. Gordana was invited here today because she's an outstanding and impressive scientist, but also she was recognized among both men and women as an expert in the field of biomedical engineering. However, in addition to that, it's especially gratifying to have Gordana here at NIH at this time, as the NIH Working Group on Women in Biomedical Careers is stressing the recognition and advancement of women in fields of science, and her career is exemplary of a woman who has succeeded in a scientific field in which women are only now beginning to get their due recognition for their contributions. One subcommittee of the NIH Working Group on Women in Biomedical Careers is working closely with NIBIB to focus on integrating and advancing women in biomedical sciences into women engineers into biomedical sciences. So as part of this subcommittee's efforts, engineering has been added to the NIH Director's Wednesday afternoon lecture series, and a particular effort was made to find an outstanding woman engineer scientist. So I'd like to thank the working group, this particular subcommittee, and NIBIB for making Gordana's visit possible today. Gordana is a professor at the Department of Biomedical Engineering at Columbia University. She's a professor of biomedical engineering and surgery and the director of the Laboratory for Stem Cells and Tissue Engineering. And she's also co-director of the NIH Tissue Engineering Research Center. She received her PhD in chemical engineering from the University of Belgrade. And from 1986 to 1987, she was a Fulbright Fellow at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And prior to coming to Columbia, she was on faculty of the Department of Chemical Engineering of the University of Belgrade as Professor of Chemical Engineering until 1993. She then joined the Harvard-MIT Division for Health Sciences and Technology, where she still holds an appointment as visiting scientist. Gordana's research is highly interdisciplinary, merging engineering with science. Her work is in advanced technologies for biophysical regulation of human stem cells, bioreactor design, and functional tissue engineering. The focus of her laboratory is on two distinctly different groups of tissues that are of high clinical interest, cardiac and orthopedic. In both areas, there's strong interest in studies and of the interactions of molecular and physical factors that mediate cell differentiation and functional assembly. Gordana has published over 200 peer-reviewed articles. She's written two books, has 25 patents, and she's a frequent advisor to governmental organizations on tissue engineering and regenerative medicine. She organized and chaired some of the top conferences in her area of expertise, including the NIH Workshop on Tissue Engineering, the Next Generation in 2005, and the 2007 Keystone Symposium on Tissue Engineering and Developmental Biology, which is a key conference in bringing together engineers and developmental biologists. She's received numerous awards for her research, publications, and patents. In 2002, she was elected a fellow of the American Institute for Medical and Biological Engineering. In today's talk, titled Tissue Engineering and the Challenges of Imitating Nature, Gordana will discuss biologically inspired tissue engineering and the utilization of stem cells and advanced culture systems for regenerative medicine and biological research. I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Gordana Vunjak-Novakovic.
Thank you so much, Catherine. I'm really deeply honored to be here. I am enjoying my visit tremendously, and I would like to sincerely thank the organizers for inviting me. My interest is really in the interplay between engineering and biology in a broad sense, and I try to, in this title, to really capture the message I would like to convey, which is that tissue engineering is generally these days inspired by biology, developmental and adult biology. This is where we lift our recipes, this is where we learn how we can build tissues. But then actually there is a reverse arrow, there is a feedback, because everything we do to engineer tissues goes back in many different ways to benefit biology and medicine. This is pretty much what I will try to tell you today. I found this comparison of these two slides interesting because it tells something about recent history of tissue engineering. There was a cover story in the Life magazine in 1989 that was entitled "Replaceable You." So they asked experts in the country, how can we replace body parts and organs that are terminally failing? And this was the vision. And you can see that this is all ceramics and stainless steel and artificial materials. So this was the view of regenerative medicine in 1989. 10 years later, another magazine, same, pretty much the same title, but you can see very distinctly different view. Everything is grown in culture, everything is cell-based. And I think that this is significant because this is exactly the time when actually different disciplines of science and engineering became ready for the big integration. The concept of tissue engineering, for those that are really not in this field, is remarkably simple. So here are the cells, and I would like to tell you today in many different examples that actually when we talk about tissue engineers, this is not me or any of you, this is the cell. So this is the only engineer or architect of the tissue. And what we really engineer are the environments for these cells in vitro or in vivo to do their job. So the ultimate tissue engineer is combined by a biomaterial in form of a scaffold or matrix and a culture environment that can make cells on a biomaterial to organize themselves in a certain way, and then this tissue construct, if the conditions are right, is being implanted to replace one of the organs. So this is just a general concept. And I'll add this slide, which is actually famous or infamous, the way you like it, but I think it's very significant because this slide tells us two important things from early times of tissue engineering. What was done is that actually cartilage cells that were taken from the tip of the rib were dissociated from the tissue matrix and seeded onto a fibrous polymer scaffold that was shaped in the form of a human ear. And these cells were cultured, and over time they deposited matrix and make some kind of very primitive immature ear structure. This ear was implanted under the skin of the ear of this rabbit. So what we see is that actually it was possible indeed to make delicate three-dimensional biologically based structures, and at least in this case, once this structure was implanted in vivo, it remained its shape. I mean, it stayed in a form of an ear. So this is the way I take the main message from these studies. So that we don't think that everything started yesterday or 10 years ago, I just put together this little history slide to remind all of us that there was a huge interest in helping people to survive failure of their organs. And I think that this is really ultimate mission of tissue engineering and regenerative medicine, to make us live longer than the organ, one of our organs that's failing. So you see examples even like before the new era in China and other countries, when people were trying to actually use autografts and pieces of tissues to actually do some kinds of like repairs and transplantations. Sort of new era starts a little bit more than 100 years ago, and actually it starts with a time when cells were cultured in vitro, at that time in glass dishes, that Julius Petri, who was assistant to Robert Koch, who is famous after discovering tuberculosis, and he named these dishes after himself. So these are the Petri dishes that we today use in their plastic variation. And then exactly 100 years ago, there was a remarkable experiment that was done by Ross Harrison, who was able to maintain amphibian embryos in culture for very long periods of time. And he was even able to differentiate very immature embryonic tissues and to show outgrowth of nerves. People were looking at these experiments, you know, in certain ways at that time, but actually this really formed the basis for some subsequent experiments that Alexis Carrel was doing with adult tissues and many other things. And they find it also curious that actually one of the most prominent biologists was the one who established perfusion in tissue culture, something that we use a lot today, and we are very proud of our ability to perfuse tissue and keep them alive. And this biologist was Charles Lindbergh, I mean the same Lindbergh that flew over the ocean, which tells about his interdisciplinarity, I think. And then what follows is actually the era of growth factors, in the 60s, cyclosporine that actually enabled the use of allografts, and then finally, nobody knows what's the starting year, but let's say in 80s or 90s, tissue engineering started the way we know it. One thing is that actually you can still do a lot of biology using these same petri dishes, but I will also try to show you, in addition to medical applications, direct medical applications of tissue engineering, that you can do a lot studying cells in isolation, but there are some serious limitations, and there is a next level of biology that could be done if you are able to make better in more controllable in vitro systems. So essentially the overall idea that I would like to discuss today is that we start from all and any information that can be that we can lift from developmental biology. So we are trying to look into embryonic development to understand processes that actually govern the proliferation and fate of the stem cells that build organisms and organs, and processes that also govern the functional assembly of these cells into tissue structures. We know very little, but actually any knowledge that we can derive from there is extremely helpful because it provides a rational basis for our approaches. And our approaches are actually to try to recreate in vitro some aspects on the conditions that cells are experiencing normally during the development. This is ideal because then you take the best possible, you utilize in a best possible way the biosynthetic and genetic machinery of the cell. The complication arises from the fact that actually it is not only one signal, there are multiple cues, some of them are molecular, some of them are physical, and nothing is ever uniform in biology, you have gradients in time and space, and things are interactive. But whatever information we have, we are placing these cells into the context that we design by a scaffold or matrix scaffold, like a scaffold that we use to build buildings. Scaffold provides a structural and logistic template for cell attachment and tissue formation, and the bioreactor provides the entirety of conditions from environmental control to cascades of molecular and physical regulatory factors. So this is the approach that we'll be discussing. To pursue this approach, we need to build the tools, and this is a very large part of what we do today. So we are developing scaffolding materials that are suitable for the application that we are trying to pursue. For example, if you are trying to make a vascularized tissue structure, we will look for a scaffold that's elastic, very highly porous, and channeled. If you are growing human embryonic stem cells, you will mostly look for some kind of hydrogel. If you go into orthopedic tissues, maybe we can use one of the many variations of self-fibroin protein that's coated by mineral. So scaffolds are generally custom designed as well as the bioreactors. So in some cases, dynamically fluid dynamically active environment is key, like for cartilage. In other cases, you need mechanical loading or you need electrical stimulation. And I'll show you examples of culture systems of bioreactor that combine some of these features. In many cases, we have this modular approach that you try to put together multiple components that you need and get systems that meet some of the requirements of a specific tissue engineering system. So this is a sort of summary of this introduction. Tissue engineering and developmental biology really these days work together. Cell is in the center of both worlds. From developmental biology, we actually get requirements and inspiration for the design of tissue engineering systems. From tissue engineering, we get tissues as three-dimensional models for studies of cell function, development, disease. So this is how the two areas really work interactively for the ultimate benefit of regenerative medicine, which can have where we are trying to grow functional tissue grafts, and for benefit of biology, where we are trying to walk away from flat biology whenever it makes sense. This is not universal, clearly, but actually there are many instances where working in 3D or working in with a more complex system can enable you to do more than you can possibly do in a petri dish, because cells really interact with their context, with the environment. It is not just the living cell. So I'll try to give you, in most of this talk, I'll give you some examples of tissue engineering, because it's much easier to see how things work together through examples. And these examples will cover some work on cartilage, on bone, on osteochondral grafts, cardiac muscle, vascularized tissues. And then in the last shorter part, I will show you some of the technologies that we developed to serve tissue engineering, but actually the use of which goes outside and beyond tissue engineering, and they can be used for some basic biological and medical research. So first, cartilage. For cartilage, there is a consensus that actually cartilage does not regenerate. This is an old truth, very well documented. And one of the therapies that actually works best these days is called mosaicplasty, where actually the defect in the load-bearing area, in the loaded area, is being filled by little plugs of cartilage that are taken from less loaded and therefore less important areas. So an obvious question is, this works, by the way, this works pretty well. Actually, there is pain is relieved and load bearing is restored. But the question is, can we do this without making damage here? Because this is very often source of osteoarthritis. And this is an inspiration for actually growing plugs of cartilage that's made using cells that can be either chondrocytes or chondrogenic cells or stem cells, for example, from bone marrow, that are loaded onto the scaffold. And two dominant culture systems used thus far are actually the one where you have very dynamic fluctuations of pressure and velocity. So the tissues are grown in some kind of dynamic suspension, and the other is a system with mechanical loading, with a dynamic compressive loading. In either case, under appropriate conditions, you will get relatively large pieces of cartilage. There is no problem to grow millimeter thick cartilage in practically any size. And this cartilage, as you will see, is further studied in animal models to repair joints. One thing we learned relatively early from this process is, if you just look here at the bottom, this is a cross-section of a disc, which is about a centimeter in diameter, that is seeded by the cells. The process of chondrogenesis really starts at the edge, in the area of very high cell density, and then is progressing as the front apositionally, inwards and outwards. And then after a period that depends on your culture conditions, but is generally 4 to 6 weeks, you get a piece of relatively uniformly cartilaginous tissue. It is important that this really mimics in many ways the process of limb development, cartilage development during in a normal organism, where actually high cell density triggers chondrogenesis, and this precartilaginous tissue condensation triggers the development of cartilage. We tried to culture these tissues for a very long periods of time, in one instance for up to 7 months, to learn a very important lesson, which is that we cannot always compensate with time the deficiencies of our culture systems. And we were very disappointed seeing that we can grow a lot of proteoglycan and come into normal range of composition, and even come into the normal range of equilibrium modulus, which is compressive stiffness of cartilage, but that we lack collagen and we lack dynamic compressive stiffness of cartilage. And then finally, when we went back to biology and compared how cartilage tissue properties change with age, we found that what we can do in culture is actually to grow fetal-type cartilage. So this is the quality that we can achieve. And then the body needs to finish the process because we simply don't know what are the factors, what are all the factors that actually lead towards full maturation of cartilage. And I think that this is, at this time, pretty sure for all tissues that we grow. This is how much we can achieve. So you actually push the cells to go in the right direction, but then the body eventually has to finish the processes. So just to summarize, the quality is that we have about 3/4 of normal concentration of proteoglycan, less than 1/2 of normal concentration of collagen. Collagen looks great structurally and composition-wise, except for very poor cross-linking. So this is the state of the art of engineered cartilage that we grow. It works great in a rabbit model and other animal models. So, I mean, we were able to achieve pretty good reconstruction of the whole architecture of the joint. You see, after 6 months, this beautiful cartilage that you don't see in culture with columnar cells. So this is exactly how cartilage is supposed to look, with a lot of type 2 collagen, very good reconstitution of the bone, and very good mechanical properties. So this was in an animal model that was not constrained in any way. Animal was not immobilized, was free to move. So in an animal model, this cartilage was good enough and strong enough for load-bearing immediately after implantation. Better results were obtained by another group. Now we are at the same department. They used a hydrogel. And they showed that the combination of cell encapsulation and hydrogel and sequential application of growth factors and loading, this is actually an approach that's also pursued here very extensively by Rocky Tuan's group, gave the absolutely best compressive properties of cartilage with primary chondrocytes. So these tissues came into physiologic range already after 4 or 5 weeks of cultivation. So this is the very good news. The less good news is that actually agarose, the only hydrogel that works in this way, that works very well for cartilage formation, is not biocompatible, doesn't degrade, and also the properties of agarose cannot be really changed. So it is still not known what makes agarose such a great material for cartilage formation. So very recently, a postdoc who before that got her degree with Dr. Hung, who actually worked on agarose, and she did part of this work for her PhD thesis, just by serendipity and through our collaboration with David Kaplan, who's very favorite material is silk, so we have a lot of silk in our lab and we try all variations. So just by serendipity, Grace actually started to immobilize chondrocytes in silk. And nothing worked, and then one day, one preparation worked. So we have a magic composition of silk that gives exactly the same result as agarose. And what we are now trying to do, now tissue engineering really comes into the picture in collaboration with David, is actually to use silk, which is biocompatible, degradable, and tunable. All properties are tunable. First, to understand what is it that really makes the hydrogel work for cartilage formation, and then actually use this system to try to develop cartilage tissue engineering system that is based on human mesenchymal stem cells. Another tissue that we are work a lot on is bone. What's different for bone is actually that it is a vascularized tissue. So to keep cells viable and metabolically active, we need to perfuse our cultures, which means like we need an interstitial flow through the tissue. And we developed quite a few bioreactor systems in which these tissues, this is a MATLAB simulation, are actually perfused with fluid in a way that gives very even distribution of the flow through the tissues. In order to learn, similar to the example with cartilage, what exact scaffold properties are best for the formation of bone, we started to work with decellularized bone that has absolutely ideal composition and mechanical properties, and then seed human mesenchymal cells onto this decellularized bone and cultured in this perfusion system. Once we determined the perfusion rate, cell seeding, and other parameters, we then switched to another scaffold, which is, in this case, a tailorable scaffold. So this is silk fibroin porous scaffold made out of silk. And then we seeded silk with human mesenchymal stem cells and have grown over a period of 5 weeks. In our under our very best conditions, we come into the range of poor quality human bone. So this would be like osteoporotic quality of bone with about 12% by volume of the fraction of the mineralized tissue. And it is very remarkable that actually these cells find a way to make this beautifully shaped trabeculae that look very normal and to somehow connect them and to make this structure that you see in a micro CT image, top view and side view, with relatively uniform and relatively dense bone structure. The next obvious question is, can we intervene, can we tailor the structure of bone? Because if you look into, this is just an example, this is the vertebra. If you look into the bone, it's very hierarchically organized. So there are regions with small pore size, regions with large pore size, low porosity, high porosity. So we made a series of polymer scaffolds that are all made of silk, but actually had different pore sizes, either small uniform pores or large uniform pores or a gradient. So you have small pores, large pores here. And then we seeded the cells, we put this into bioreactor and looked what happened. And it was actually interesting and nice to see that the scaffold geometry that was described as a very small pore size, very high density scaffold, resulted in a bone that had structural properties of the flat bone, like a calvarial bone, while very large pore sizes resulted in something that looked like a trabecular bone. And the compositions of these bone, biochemical compositions, also correlated actually with a specific bone type. So bone morphology could be directed to some extent by just scaffold design. We tried to see if it works. So again, in animal models, so these are two separate experiments. So the bone with very small pores were tested in a calvarial defect in a mouse. And we compared this bone with just freshly seeded scaffolds with mesenchymal stem cells and then scaffolds alone and unfilled defects. And as we expected and hoped for, tissue engineered bone had the best healing. We were a little bit surprised and disappointed that cells and scaffolds when used alone didn't do much, but actually the engineered bone did. And then the other bone that was more like calvarial bone was made in a shape of a cylindrical graft and then tested again in an animal model of a critical size femoral defect. And again, it could be seen that there is healing. With bone, healing is really not a problem. It's bridging the gap. So you really, the requirement is not very high. And honestly, it is much more difficult to engineer cartilage and to make cartilage integrate, in spite of the fact that this is like a simpler tissue, than to engineer bone and to make it integrate. We are putting the two together by trying to grow osteochondral grafts. This is again effort that's actually supported by NIH through the NIDCR. So we are trying to grow osteochondral grafts using the same cells throughout the graft and then achieving selective differentiation into cartilaginous layer on the top and the bone layer on the bottom. And you see here an example of this graft that has a bony part and cartilaginous part. These are the initial grafts where we combined porous and hydrogel material. So we are going towards all silk graft, and this is degradable silk, so we follow this concept of degradation. For these grafts, we use bioreactors that actually have perfusion through the bone part and mechanical loading of the cartilage cap. We are also trying to refine these experiments in a way that we make anatomically correct grafts. And this is done for two reasons. One reason is, this is shown here on the example of the TMJ temporomandibular joint. We are trying to show that you can take a that you can start from a medical image of the joint. If one joint is damaged, then you take the healthy one and then make a mirrored image. And then we can make a scaffold of the type that I showed with the hydrogel cap and the porous part here, both regions being seeded with the cells, ideally from the patient, either bone marrow aspirate or liposuction. Then we culture this in a bioreactor, which is again anatomically correct, and then we go back and implant the whole graft. So one idea is to see, can we probe our methods to the extent that we see that we make like whole regions or like whole joints in this case. The other reason is more like fundamental and scientific, which is if you have systems with loading, then you know that loading and perfusion, both of them, are very different in anatomically shaped grafts than in something that's straight and the form of plug. So we were really interested to see how our in vitro systems work with something that's anatomically correct. And these are some of the results that we collected so far. This is the bone region. You can see very nicely organized viable cells in the bone part. This is live dead assay, so green is alive. This is our initial scaffold. You see it here. This is the bone that was grown in the anatomical shape. This is a little bit of Warren's analysis, like how shall we do that? I have a huge collection of these drawings from the brainstorming sessions how to do that, because this is an extremely complex, anatomically complex piece. These are some of our first prototypes of the scaffold materials. You see they're sitting on needles in a cap. And this is the first prototype. This is very typical for the lab. I mean, you just put together what you have to sort of start. And this is the real bioreactor that was made on some experiences and mistakes from here. So this is pretty much where I'm just using examples from our lab, but I think the overall concept and overall approach really reflects tissue engineering as it is today, because I believe that most groups are really trying to have very close connection with developmental biologists and clinicians and try to work things between biology and engineering. My third example is actually about the heart tissue, and the heart is, even for an engineer, like a total marvel of structure and function. And because of the complexity of the heart, I mean, your first reaction is that you shouldn't even like dare to try to engineer something. But then actually, when you go down and try to derive some engineering requirements, you can come to three factors that are really dominant if you're attempting to engineer a piece of heart muscle. First of all, I mean, we are really talking about a little patch of heart tissue. I mean, nothing more than that. So the first thing is that there is a very high density of the cells in the heart. It's about 100 million cells per centimeter cube, per milliliter. These cells are very hard workers. So the numbers are that actually our heart has 3 billion cells, and these cells are pretty much not renewed. I mean, most of them stay there for the duration of our life. For an average lifetime, they beat, each of these cells would beat 3 billion times, and they pump an enormous amount of blood, about, 2,000 gallons, if you think in gallons, through vasculature, which is 100,000 miles. So the numbers are remarkable. These hardworking cells use a lot of oxygen. Nature takes care of this by actually providing very dense vasculature, so that each fiber in the heart is flanked between two capillaries. And this is what you see. Actually, this is an actual photograph of a human heart that was filled with polymer and then the tissue was removed. So we need to take care of, think of this, we need to take care of very efficient local supply of oxygen. And then the third thing is how the heart works. Actually, the electrical field electrical signals come from the node, from the pacer cells. They spread over the surface of the heart, and actually this orchestrates depolarization of the cellular membrane and twitching in sync of all heart cells, of all cells that have sarcomeres, and then this results in pumping of blood. This is called excitation-contraction coupling, which is excitation is electrical and then contraction is contraction of the cell. So being engineers, we have to make a chart. So we make a chart, and then we say, okay, this is native myocardium, and this is what we possibly can do using our engineering tools. So we said, okay, about the cells, we need the same cell number because these cells don't grow in number, myocytes don't renew. And because there are multiple cell types, there are myocytes, there are endothelial cells and fibroblasts, we need all these cells in co-culture, or we need stem cells capable of differentiating into these different lineages. This has to be done over clinically relevant thicknesses, which are in millimeters. Oxygen supply is by blood flow through very dense capillary network with hemoglobin as an oxygen carrier, which has very high capacity for oxygen. What we do in culture is that we are perfusing medium through scaffolds that have an array of channels, so this is mimicking to some extent capillaries, and then we use oxygen supplements, synthetic supplements, perfluorocarbon. And finally, to provide the necessary physical signaling and condition the tissue to beat in response to electrical signals, we actually do electrical stimulation during culture using suprathreshold signals, which means signals that are, these signals are shaped like the signals in the heart, but the amplitude is adjusted to cause macroscopic contractions of cultured constructs. So this is the approach. So let me start from, I'll skip the cell part. I mean, I'm not talking about the cells. I'll be happy to discuss if someone is interested. We work with animal models. We now work with, I'll show you a little bit, with human cells, human stem cells from various sources. I'll really focus on these two components, which is scaffold and bioreactor, and the result of this. Oxygen. Everyone knows that oxygen supply by diffusion, which is if you culture your piece of tissue in a petri dish, is a major problem that limits the viability and thickness of the tissue. And we measured this, and we found, we just documented by numbers something that is very well known, that cell density at the surface is physiologic. It drops very sharply as you go from the surface into the depth. This is like the surface, this is the center of the tissue. And in the center you see this very acellular, very empty environment. This is 1/4 of the big, of the disc that we grown, of the cardiac tissue that was grown in a petri dish, live dead assay. You see the edge is live, the center is dead. This correlates very well with the oxygen concentration. So here is a scale for oxygen. It's a color scale. I'm not sure how well you see, but this is like exact thing, exact profile that you see here, and then you see that the cell viability is observed only in this region of high concentration. And to make things even more difficult, it is that cell viability is not maintained at oxygen concentrations above zero. It is only maintained at oxygen concentrations that approximately correlate with the venous level of oxygen. So you have to be at oxygen levels that cells are normally seeing in the body. So we need to provide some kind of perfusion. So the first thing we did is actually to just perfuse medium through a scaffold that was seeded with the cells, and then compare this with the dish culture. This culture is here, perfused culture is here. So this is a cross-section, top, middle, bottom. And you can see that there is obviously much more cells. This was done with cardiac heart cells on a collagen scaffold. There are much more cells that were maintained after 1 week of culture in perfused system than this system. In addition, about half of the cells that you see here are dead. Viability is only 42%, and majority of the cells, about 84% here, is alive. So this is the good news. Less good news is when you look into a marker expression, and I show here just a piece of information. So this is the neonatal heart, this is perfused system, this is dish. Obviously, there are much more markers in the perfused system than in a dish culture, like this is cardiac troponin I, but if you look closely into these cells, they're sort of rounded up. which is the known response of cardiac cells to hydrodynamic shear. So cells are not happy as measured by their morphology. So we try to do something that's a little bit closer to the actual situation in the heart, which is that blood flows through capillaries and the cells don't really see blood directly. So we use these channel scaffolds, we added perfluorocarbon, and otherwise we did the same as in this experiment. The result was, this is a channel, this is the tissue, that actually by adding perfluorocarbon, we very substantially increased the level of oxygen both in the culture medium that goes through the channel and in the tissue phase, which is around the channel. You can see these micromoles here on this scale. And as a result, our cellularity measured by DNA amount increased, and excitation threshold, which is the voltage that you need to apply to make the tissue contract, decrease, which is a good thing, so these tissues are more excitable. Also important, these channels following implantation to the right heart, they're perfused with blood, and we could, in some of them, we could find blood cells. The last thing was to apply electrical stimulation. So this is just more like an artistic than technical explanation of what we have done. But essentially, we were stimulating these constructs during culture by signals that were similar to the signals of the heart. And then what you obtain is actually, this is a piece of tissue that was grown with stimulation that's about 1 centimeter long and maybe six, seven millimeters wide, a couple millimeters thick. That was, as you could see in this short video clip, contracting synchronously in response to excitation. And these are some measurements. Structure and function always go together. So this is the ultrastructure of this heart tissue. You see that if you look into the striated muscle, neonatal heart, stimulated and non-stimulated, there is certain similarity between the two. If you look into the same image in a different way, so this is a striated structure of the engineered tissue and of the neonatal tissue. You can see here in this immunofluorescent stained striations, you again see similarity. So what we have done here is really to start from populations of already differentiated cells that we totally dissociated from the tissue matrix, and then let them assemble themselves into functional structure by proper signaling. It is very encouraging that actually this dissociated cells that needed a couple days to even recover from enzyme digestion over only 8 days of culture are able to make this really nice structures and contract synchronously in response to stimulation. So this clearly has to be translated to clinically relevant sources because it's not the idea to solve the problem of rat heart implantation. I mean, we are thinking about human cell-based grafts. And actually what we are now doing over the last couple of years is actually to translating this approach onto human cell sources. We are working both with mesenchymal stem cells that we are immunoselecting to achieve like more homogeneous, more robust cell population, and also to favor a little bit vasculogenic cell properties. And we are working with human embryonic stem cells. Clearly, I mean, this is where we very, very much rely on our collaborators. So we have collaborators that are scientists who, for example, for human embryonic stem cells, we work with Gordon Keller, so we need people who know and understand the stem cells. We also experiment with a lot of materials here again, like for bone. We also use decellularized human tissue matrix, so we get rejected hearts from the heart transplantation program at Columbia, and then we developed a protocol that allows us to fully decellularize heart tissue. And so that there are no cellular material, but then you have totally preserved structure. And the value of this is that you have an ideal molecular composition, structure, and mechanical properties to put the cells on and to see what are the other signals that you need to apply to achieve cell differentiation and assembly. And we are trying to, this is the main thing that we do for all these tissues, to look into the interplay between molecular and physical factors and test our in vitro results in rigorous animal models. So what I just show here is this special scaffolding material. So this is a MD PhD student working on this. So he developed the implantation model of cardiac ischemia in rats. So we are placing these tissues into the rat and then looking into integration, vascularization, and using functional imaging, we look into ejection volume and other parameters that tells you about any functional improvement. Okay, so I have a couple more slides just to show you some technologies that are more of a general nature than only related to tissue engineering that I showed. One relatively recent effort, I mean, it took us 2 years to develop this, but it was finished relatively recently, is a microbioreactor array. So you see this is just about the size of a microscope slide. So you have 12, in this case, 16, in this case, 12 culture chambers, where you can culture either monolayer of cells or a little plug, say cells in hydrogel, so three-dimensional model. The nice thing about this is that each of these chambers is totally independently supplied by culture medium. So they are truly, they don't talk to each other, they don't communicate. And for each row, you can change medium composition. So for example, here you could have three media compositions with either four replicates, or you can change cell density or something else along these lines. So you have these different culture settings. We combine many, many of these, connect them to the pumps, and then place them in an incubator. I won't go into this. We actually use a lot of mathematical modeling of the flow and other conditions, so we were trying to figure out what are the conditions that are suitable for specific applications. And we tested these systems with this system with lots of cells. The main interest from our and our collaborators is actually for the work with stem cells. So here is an example of one particular line of human embryonic stem cells that was cultured in this system as compared to the conventional static culture. Actually, I forgot to mention, I'm sorry, one thing, the heart, the cardiac work is also done, supported by NIH. So this is our other major long-term effort that we are pursuing with the NIH funding. And these are a sort of side, this was not specifically funded by anything, this is one of the side products of our work. And these are more extensive data for human embryonic stem cells. So this was another interesting story because we tried to, in this particular case, to sort of go to first principles. We found just accidentally that actually feeder layers that are normally used for embryonic stem cells express very large amounts of hyaluronic acid. And it is also very well known that actually hyaluronic acid is present during very early development and then levels go down. So we tried to see if a biomaterial that was based on hyaluronic acid could be a good biomaterial for the cultivation of embryonic stem cells. And after many iterations, actually we found that it should be hydrogel because these cells like to be encapsulated. And then we used hyaluronic-based hydrogel that was adjusted with respect to mechanical properties and diffusional properties and whatnot, and developed a system for self-renewal or proliferation, if you like, of embryonic stem cells encapsulated in these hydrogels. So they don't have to grow on monolayers, they can be encapsulated and grow in a hydrogel. One nice feature of this system is that actually you can switch between self-renewal and differentiation just by changing medium composition. You don't need to put cells in monolayer and then into embryoid bodies and back and forth. One other effort that goes in parallel with the cardiac effort and supports cardiac effort is something that we really need is actually to achieve vascularization. And vascularization is clearly a universal problem of most tissues, and this is a two-level problem. On one hand, we need the capillary bed, so we need sprouting of the cells so that we can get these little capillaries that can bring oxygen to the individual cells. On the other level, we need larger vessels because fluid has to, and then blood after implantation has to go through these channels. And these two need to be connected. So what we are doing is for the larger structures, they are actually using microfabrication techniques to make hydrogels and elastomer scaffolds with very thin, very narrow channels that are either parallel channels or connected into this kind of structure. So here you see a microscopic image of the cells that are on one of these. So this is like this region here. So this is done by fabrication, while the generation of the capillary bed is mostly done by inducing cell sprouting by growth factors. And one thing that we are trying to achieve, it's relatively easy to achieve sprouting and formation of initial capillary network using BGF. The hard part is to get stable blood vessels, so we are actually collaborating with people who know more than we do about this to see how can we use sequential application of the growth factors and achieve stability. And then I think this is either last or second to last slide. We also grow for the application as disease model or for drug studies, very small tissue organoids. What's shown here are cardiac organoids that are about a millimeter long and say 100 micrometers in diameter. So they're very, very small, which means you can put lots of them into something that would correspond to 96-well plate and have high throughput screening of conditions. So they are small, which is good. But they also reduce the amount of cells and growth factors and other materials you use, but they're actually large enough to do physiologic studies. So you see here a trace of one contraction of one of these organoids, and you see here that actually we measure the increase in that contraction amplitude with time. So this is really convenient if you want to study effect of hypoxia or cardiotoxicity of a drug, because cells in monolayers really respond to all these signals in a different way than three-dimensional cells. We are very, very interested, as you know, in electrical stimulation, so we are now extending this from the heart tissue engineering into cell differentiation. So these are human mesenchymal stem cells, and what we are observing is that actually there is an orientation and alignment of these cells and stronger development of the internal network, of the actin network in these cells. So we are actually looking into the use of electrical signaling clearly in conjunction, in concert with other factors to direct cell differentiation in desired way. We are working on several disease models. I'll just show very briefly one of them as an example to show you what we do. This is a collaboration with Anne-Marie Schmidt. She's a great expert for ages and rages. Ages are actually, these are the advanced glycolation and products. So these are actually and this is the receptor for this molecule. These are actually molecules that are very much involved in diabetes-related vascular disease. And we are now looking, using a microfluidic system in vitro, into the responses of cells in this, like a vascular in vitro model, to the stress that is stress caused by glucose level and by hydrodynamic shear. So this is actually one of the systems we use. And then finally, actually, we started a couple of years ago to closely collaborate with biologists. This is one example of the project where we made a microfluidic system that is capable to, like this central part is the active part, you see blowing up here. So by flowing fluid here and fluid here, say this is plain medium, for example, and this is medium with a specific factor dissolved, we can make a gradient across the cells. And in a particular case, this is done in collaboration with Randall Moon. The focus of his interest is wind. So we are looking here into gradients of wind the cells are exposed to, and how cells respond, how wind, how gradients of wind actually affect the beta-catenin signaling and cell polarity. So this is one of the very exciting projects, because this is like going back to biology, you know, when your tools are going to be used by others. So instead of summarizing, I would just like to list some of the open questions, and I think these are the questions that many laboratories are working on these days. And I call them challenges, and there are three groups, I believe. Group number one is the human cell source. We all know there is no ideal or reproducible or established human cell source for any of these applications. We have many different candidates that we really need to look into. We need to seriously pursue cell culture without animal components, defined systems. And there is a growing need to standardize things, because we cannot even compare data between the labs, because everyone has their favored protocol. So this is an important thing. Challenge number two are enabling technologies, or we can call them tools. We do need to work more. We are now ready probably for the next level of the development of cell instructive environments, the components of which are scaffolds, bioreactors, and imaging. And talking about imaging, which is extremely important for us, especially real-time imaging, there are two kinds that we particularly need, and we are trying to work on this, which is molecular imaging, because then you can study the signaling, and functional imaging, where you can monitor the tissue responses. Vascularization is a universal problem of all regenerative medicine and tissue engineering, and I think it is also rigorous, animal models, like how to test your tissues, and there are many, many issues, especially if you work with human cells, so this is not a trivial problem. The third area is something that we can call overhanging fruit. This is, if we are not ready to go into medical applications right now with all these tissues, we are definitely ready to offer them to the scientific and medical community to actually support high throughput screening, to provide biomimetic context for studies of the cells. And for medical research, some really interesting tissue models of development and disease are emerging that are easy to use. They're relatively easy to use and can give you a lot. We are also trying, with a great help of NIH, to pursue, to actually help bridge the still existing gap between biology, engineering, or if you want, science, engineering. So there are some nice things that were happening this year, either as conferences that brought under the same roof different communities and actually sparked quite a few true interdisciplinary collaborative efforts. There were some, we wrote some articles and special journal issues. And actually, there is a lot of collaboration, I think, this last couple of years, much more than before. And the very last slide, actually, this is my current lab group. So these are the people behind the effort, like I always think this is the best group there is, but this is not fair to say, because I think many of you think the same for your groups, but it's a very collaborative research between these people, and this is actually some of the translation of our tissue engineering efforts into other areas. This is the Valentine's Day webpage, so we were treated because of some publication with this, like, mending broken hearts web page. This is from the Toronto newspaper, and this is the last cake from a birthday party in the lab. So I would like to thank you for your attention, and we'll be more than happy to answer any questions either now or later. If you think of something, email to me, and I'll be happy to correspond. Thank you.
Just wanted to remind everyone that there's a reception following the question and answer session, so please stick around to talk with Gordana after your questions as well.
Okay. Yes, please.
I was intrigued with your work on the cartilaginous tissue and following with interest, as my knee joints are complaining at the end of the day when I climb the stairs. So considering the pathology of the calf and the damage that occurs in either osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis, it is very inhomogeneous, almost a challenge to reconstruct the system. What is your thought how to use it in regenerative knee joints? Into real practice.
I cannot agree more with you. I mean, you are absolutely right, and we are not anywhere close. I think everything we do is a learning curve at this time. I think it's impossible to say that we are close to repairing even major defects in healthy joints, and in particular if there is an arthritic joint. But I think that with all these things that you can learn down the road, you know, engineering tissues and using them for testing of various kinds can help a lot to eventually get to this point, because the diseases that you mentioned are the systemic diseases. This will not change following implantation. I mean, the same factors that caused arthritis will still be there. So it's unrealistic to expect like everything will be wonderful after the implantation. But I'm born optimist, and I think that we are going in the right direction, and one day it will click. You know, we will understand what exactly needs to be done to actually treat the disease in some way. And there are also multiple approaches. I mean, I don't want to leave the impression that this is the approach or the only approach. I mean, many groups are working in parallel, and the hope is that one of these approaches will eventually, you know, bear some fruits and help us live longer and better.
And a short question regarding the silk peptide, because it is a foreign protein as an extracellular matrix, do you see any inflammatory response because of the implementation the animal model?
Yeah, this would be a longer answer, so I think maybe we can talk later. I can give you a little bit more detail. Yeah. We tried inkjet. Inkjet is excellent for certain applications because it's very simple and it allows you to have little droplets of hydrogel that in principle can contain different factors or different cells. There are two exceptions where we cannot use it. One is resolution of inkjet printing is not particularly high. So if you really need something that's less than a millimeter or something, then it doesn't work. The other possible problem with inkjet printing is I don't know how to make vascular network, like a precursor for vascular network. So this remains a problem. It's possible that they will solve this problem. But except for cartilage, all tissues need vasculature. And then you can build, if you're building a thicker structure, I mean, I don't know how you bring in vascular network if you don't have some kind of channeling. But I think it's a very creative and very simple and very good approach for very, and also you can make another advantage is you can make different shapes. You can make a tube, you can make like any shape that you like. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, when you grow cartilage in vitro, do you ever use perichondria?
You know, we experimented with perichondrium a long time ago for a limited amount of time, not anymore. We tried to learn as much as we could with very simple animal source, which are bovine chondrocytes. And now we spend 90% of our time for cartilage work on the use of human mesenchymal cells from either bone marrow or liposuctions, because we think that these two, because these cells are chondrogenic, both of these cell types, and they are much easier to obtain than perichondrium. So
Gordana, that's a very interesting talk. I just note with interest that that you and other people are now beginning to use these scaffold derived from decellularized decellularized tissue. So it's sort of like the old Kalon theory, where whatever's good for the tissue comes from that tissue. And of course, the prime example is bone morphogenetic protein, originally isolated from bone. I'm just wondering whether are we going back to some extent and utilizing these native matrix, and if that's if we want to do that, can
okay.
we enhance that material?
I'm not sure, Rocky. We tested these fully decellularized tissues. They're immunocompatible, so they could be implanted.
Right.
I still think that we will not end up using this. We will just learn, like we have done for bone, how exactly to build a scaffold. Because there are two advantages. I mean, one is, if you have ideal scaffold for yourselves, then you can really focus on your attention on hydrodynamic flow, electrical signaling, but not supplemental growth factors. So part of the problem is removed. And then when you figure out this part of equation, then you can go back and say, okay, let's now build a scaffold. And I think this is what we will most likely do. But I'm not sure if we are totally excluding the possibility of using decellularized human tissues as scaffolds, because they are available, and but I don't think we will. I think it's more
like a teaching tool.
I think it's more like a teaching tool. Bone is different because for bone it was for a long time no other source of BMPs.
Right.
I mean, it was only bone itself. So
because a lot of people are actually using tissue cultured,
generated
scaffolds that have been decellularized and then use them for tissue engineering applications.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to think that all that kind of stuff that we used to do many years ago sort of comes back.
I'm not sure, but I think we will, like if you're talking about the heart scaffold, I think we will end up with the variation of this elastomer that we are now using, because you can just design it any way you like. We just like the knowledge, you know, like what exactly you want to the scaffold to be. So.
Thank you, Gardan. It was an excellent talk. You made a general comment is that most of the time when you make your tissues in vitro, they don't mature fully in vitro, and you need to transplant them in vivo. They complete their functional maturation in vivo. So it seems like it can be a situation when it's too little or too much, right? So have you investigated the issue of the right, whatever the right time is,
when is it
the right time to transplant? Yeah. And can
you
draw any rules for
this? This is a great comment, and actually this question, how much is enough, is one of the big questions. We don't know, but we know some of the factors. For example, for cartilage, we know for sure that more is not better. Like if you have, we can make relatively mature cartilage, and it has excellent load bearing, but it doesn't integrate. So then we used some tricks. Actually, what we used is a sort of combo system. We even have a patent on this. I don't know. I hope it will get into patients one day. But actually, we use like a central part, which is very strong and takes care of load bearing. And then we make a little, we leave a little gap, you know, between the joint and the implant, and then fill this with totally immature tissue. Because only immature tissue builds a tissue bond. And only with immature tissue, you see this collagen, for example, getting across. You know, because otherwise, like when you put cartilages, I mean, this is what we studied the most. This is why I'm going back to this example. Like, if everything is mature and you do your histology, it looks beautiful. Like, everything is totally uniform integrated. But when you take explant, like you look at the central part, it falls out. Because everything that's keeping it together with the environment is a sort of jello-like structure. It's just protoglycan deposition. So we know for cartilage it has to be immature. I tend to think that all tissues should be immature and remodeling should be finished in the body. The question is just that needs to be answered how much of this culture, pre-development, you really need to have some minimal functionality following implantation.
Yeah,
but this is definitely
like
very, very, very important.
Lot of effort should be put into that.
Yeah.
And
then especially like if you work with human stem cells, you need to pass the point when these cells can reverse. You know this very, very well. I mean, you don't want to come into the point that cells can go back and differentiate into something else and make tumors. So you have to implant a piece that's already phenotypically stable and functional to some minimal extent. But nobody knows. I don't think we know for sure where this is. Okay. Okay, so we can now move to the...
Okay, so if there are no more questions, before moving on to the reception, just everybody please join me in thanking Gordana for an excellent talk.
Thank you.